The following presentation is distributed by Lighthouse Catholic Media, a not-for-profit corporation. To order additional copies of this presentation, make a tax-deductible donation. Browse our selection of more than 150 inspiring titles in English and Spanish, or receive more information on becoming a Lighthouse Catholic Media account manager. Please visit our website at lighthousecatholicmedia.org. Or call us toll-free at 866-526-2151. Patrick Madrid is a lifelong Catholic. He is the author or editor of 18 books on Catholic themes, including Pope Fiction, Search and Rescue, Does the Bible Really Say That?, A Year with the Bible, Envoy for Christ, and the acclaimed Surprised by Truth series. Since 1996, Patrick has been the publisher of Envoy magazine, a journal of contemporary Catholic thought, and he also serves as the director of the Envoy Institute. He hosts the Thursday edition of EWTN Radio's Open Line broadcast, heard on approximately 200 AM and FM stations across the United States, as well as globally on shortwave and on Sirius XM satellite radio. Over the past 25 years, Patrick has conducted thousands of teaching seminars at parishes, universities, and conferences across North America and around the world. He is an adjunct professor of theology at Franciscan University of Steubenville. Patrick earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Business Management from the University of Phoenix, as well as a Bachelor of Philosophy and Master's in Theology degrees from the Pontifical College Josephinum in Columbus, Ohio. Married for 31 years, Patrick and his wife Nancy have been blessed with 11 children and 11 grandchildren. For more information on his work, or to arrange for Patrick to come to speak for your parish or group, please visit patrickmadrid.com. And now, Patrick Madrid.
Thank you. And I was asked to speak to you about a very somber story. It's a true story filled with tragedy. It is not pleasant. But there are some ominous overtones and parallels between the persecution of the Catholic Church in Mexico in the 1920s and 30s, some ominous overtones and parallels then and now. So what I'd like to do is to, as best I can in the space of 55 minutes, I'd like to unfold the basic highlights, or maybe I should say lowlights, of this terrible chapter in the history of the Catholic Church in North America. I'll do my best to cover the main aspects to give you a sense of what happened and why it happened. But as I go through, I would like to ask you to be thinking in the back of your mind about some of these parallels and how they're appearing, at least, to be playing out today in the United States. I'll begin by saying that I myself am Hispanic. On my father's side, my family comes from Spain and Mexico, hence my last name, Madrid. I don't think you can get much more Spanish than that. My family had to flee from Mexico during the time of the Troubles with the persecution of the Catholic Church that was preceded by the peasant rebellion against the government. You've heard of names like Pancho Villa and Emiliano Zapata and various other people. If you go to a Mexican restaurant, typically you'll see pictures of these people on the walls, and they're glorified and made to appear as though they're these, you know, these dashing, almost larger-than-life heroes, when in fact, people like Pancho Villa and Zapata and the others who were rebelling against the government, they were murderers. They were not people to be glorified. But most people in the United States are ignorant of Mexican history. And I don't blame them, because we have our own history to try to keep track of, and that's not easy, much less to know the history in detail of other countries. But please be aware of the fact that these figures in Mexican history, as they are portrayed to us in the United States, they are portrayed to us by the people in Mexico who are in power. And I'll be describing in a little while who some of these people are. But my family had to leave the country during this time. Many of them remained. Many of them suffered for their Catholic faith. A few of them were even killed. all of my father's side of the family, the Madrids, the Molinars, the Sotos, and all the other branches of the family tree, in one way or another, they all suffered through the times that I am about to describe to you. And we can't really speak about the history of Mexico, even in just a cursory way, without spending a few moments considering the role of the Blessed Virgin Mary in the history of Mexico. I know all of you are familiar with this, but it's helpful to rehearse the details now and then. We can't forget that Mexico is a land that's directly under the special patronage and the protection of the Blessed Virgin Mary. After all, it was in 1531 that she appeared to Juan Diego, now Saint Juan Diego, declaring to him and to all the Mexican people yet to be born, she said these words, "Hear me and understand well, my son, that nothing should frighten or grieve you. Let not your heart be disturbed. Do not fear that sickness or any other sickness or anguish. Am I not here who is your mother? Are you not under my protection? Am I not your health? Are you not happily within my fold? What else do you wish? Do not grieve nor be disturbed by anything." Those are the words of Our Lady, and they're words worth thinking about today, especially given the turmoil that exists in the United States over the issue of abortion, among other issues. Those words, I think, can have a very calming effect for us, but they also remind us that we have the special intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary. We shouldn't take that for granted. These words have a special place in the hearts of Mexican Catholics who have faced many grievous challenges since the day that Our Lady uttered those words, including the persecution that I am going to describe to you now. But before I am able to properly explain what happened in the 20s and 30s, I should first talk a little bit about how we got to that point. There was a lot of ferment in Mexico, political, social ferment. There was a lot of turmoil, and this began to happen during and after Napoleon's 1808 invasion of Spain, which had led to the abdication of King Ferdinand VII, who was the monarch at the time. A new Spanish government was installed that essentially became a creature of the French crown. And you're going to see how France affected not only Spain, but also Mexico, because France was the cradle of the Enlightenment. And you all have heard the term the Enlightenment. Well, the Enlightenment in France, along with England and Germany, was a philosophical movement. It encompassed science and culture and politics and predominantly philosophy. And much of what was wrong with the Enlightenment stemmed from the fact that the Enlightenment thinkers sought to throw off, as they would regard it, the shackles of religion in favor of a robust, thoroughgoing scientism, which dispensed with things like miracles and revelation and sacraments and the church, in favor of science and the authority of the state and the autonomy of man and philosophy. The Enlightenment was, in many respects, a direct attack, not so much on the Catholic Church, but upon the idea that God himself has any role to play in human society. So it wasn't any coincidence, therefore, that we begin to see, after the Enlightenment, tremendous upheaval in continental Europe. And it wasn't restricted to Europe. After the French Revolution, and even before the French Revolution, some of these great, and when I say great, I'm using it in the way of meaning influential as opposed to good, but these very influential thinkers such as Thomas Hobbes and David Hume, Immanuel Kant, Gottfried Leibniz, John Locke, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, these and other thinkers, they really propelled quite forcefully a number of these philosophical and political movements that extended even into the United States as well as into Mexico. And although the cause of the crisis in Mexico can't be wholly explained by a cause-effect relationship with the Enlightenment, I think it's largely there that we have to look to see the roots of the coming persecution of the Catholic Church in the 1920s and 30s. And one of the major reasons for this persecution, which grew out of the Enlightenment era, is Freemasonry. Mexico has been in the death grip of Masonry for the last 200 years. It still is quite firmly in the grip of the Masonic lodges. And this is a direct cause of the persecution in the 20s and 30s, as we're about to see. But this wasn't the only problem. Certainly, Masonry was a very bad blight on Mexican culture, as it still is. But there were other problems. The government nationalized most of the the industries as a way to not only control the wealth, but also to serve the corruption that existed and still exists in the government. Corruption went hand in hand with poverty, because if the money that is being generated by these types of enterprises is being held in the hands of a few rich oligarchs, then that means that the vast amount of people, the vast majority, are suffering as a result. So poverty, then as now, has played a major factor in so much of Mexico's history and also Mexico's problems. People look at Mexico and they say, how come they can't just get it together? Well, it's partly due to that entrenched hand-in-hand combination of poverty on the one side and the corruption on the other. And of course, masonry has played a very big role in both. Now, we need to dial back just a little further to understand how this terrible persecution came to exist in the 20s and 30s. We'll have to go back to the 18th century into the 19th century to a man named Hidalgo. Hidalgo was a Catholic priest. He was born in May of 1753, and he died in July of 1811. As a Catholic priest, he was very well known for his learning. He was very popular as an author. He wrote many books. He was capable of speaking and preaching and writing effectively in many native Indian languages. And that not only enamored him to the Indians, who were populous in the state of Guanajuato, where he was, but it also made his message of independence from the Spanish crown popular with the mestizos, the Mexicans who were the mixture of Spanish blood and Indian blood. And he became famous in September 16th of 1810 when he preached a rousing message to the local town on the necessity of independence from Spain. This speech was later entitled El Grito de Dolores, which means the cry of pain. And it was the pain of the people who, at least as it was described, were suffering under the heavy yoke of the Spanish crown. And what followed was a genuine uprising. The peasants, they rose up and they began to fight for independence, but they were quickly crushed by the superior numbers and equipment and training of the Spanish soldiers who were garrisoned there. In January 16th of 1811, the rebels, with Father Hidalgo at their head, they were decisively vanquished in the Battle of Calderon. Now, he himself escaped, but he was eventually betrayed to the Spanish by his own forces. The Spaniards, after they caught him, they detained him for a few days, and then they executed him by firing squad in Chihuahua on June 26th of 1811. You may be saying, well, why is Patrick Madrid talking about this man Hidalgo? What does this have to do with the persecutions that would come over a century later? Well, it has to do with the fact that he, as a Catholic priest, was ever since that time seen as an icon of Mexican independence. So we have this national consciousness in Mexico that perceives the church as, in a certain sense, a liberator from oppression, a liberator from the unjust laws that had been invoked upon these people. And so ever since that time, the notion of the church being on the side of the people was very strong. It continues to be strong. But as the influence of Masonry grew and grew and grew in Mexican politics, and as Masons began to further and further control the political system and eventually all the major government offices, their antipathy toward the Catholic Church got to the point where they realized that they had to do something to remove this obstacle from their midst. Moving a little further later, during the time of the U.S. Civil War, the United States also, with plenty of Masons involved in the government, the United States demonstrated its commitment to the Monroe Doctrine, which was declared in 1823, and that doctrine vowed opposition to any effort on the part of any European to colonize anywhere in the Western Hemisphere or to meddle in the affairs of any country in the Western Hemisphere. Therefore, the United States, politically and in various other ways, opposed Maximilian von Habsburg, who was the brother of the Emperor von Habsburg of Austria-Hungary. Maximilian came to Mexico under various pretexts from certain Mexican leaders, and he was named the Emperor of Mexico, and that was a very short-lived expedition. His adventure came to a close in 1867, when after the French government withdrew their support in the form of money and troops that had been stationed in Mexico to prop up Maximilian's government. When that was withdrawn, than Benito Juarez, another figure that I'm sure you've heard of. If you fly to Mexico City, the major airport in Mexico City is Benito Juarez International Airport. Well, he was the one on the side of the Republican government. They did not want monarchs in Mexico, and he was the one leading the opposition to Maximilian. Eventually, Maximilian was toppled, he was captured, and in spite of all the pleas from various heads of state in Europe, including the Pope and many other people around the world imploring him to spare Maximilian's life and send him into exile, nonetheless, Benito Juarez murdered him in cold blood by a firing squad. So Mexico then became firmly under the control of the Republican form of government. And I need to emphasize that when I speak about the Mexican Republican form of government, it has nothing whatsoever to do with republicanism in the United States. So regardless of your political party, don't think in terms of Democrat and Republican in the United States whenever you hear this term Republican. There's no connection. What was President Benito Juarez's first act officially when he took office in 1867? Well, the very first act was to confiscate the Catholic parish of San Francisco in Mexico City and turn it into a Masonic temple. So if that gives you any idea of where things were headed, I think you can see the kind of influence the Masons had. When Pope Leo XIII's encyclical in 1884, Humanum Genus, had come out, it included a condemnation of Masonry, and the Mexican government banned any publication of this encyclical. Now, for about 30 years, between December of 1881 and May of 1911, there was in office President Porfirio Diaz, and he was not particularly harsh on the Catholic Church. He did not make things difficult for the Catholic Church. And for that 30-year period, things were relatively quiet. But the troubles started soon after that, and they led to a crisis that I'm going to describe here in just a moment. But what we saw was this rise of the anti-Catholic Masonic presidents in Mexico, the worst of them being Plutarco Elias Calles. We begin with Francisco Madero, who reigned from 1911 to 1913. I probably should say he held office, not reigned. He was followed by Victoriano Huerta, who was in office from 1913 to 1914. And we have a couple of little presidencies that lasted a week here, a month there, so we won't talk about them. The next major figure was Venustiano Carranza. Now, Carranza was in office from 1914 through 1920, and he was a determined foe of the Catholic Church. He did many terrible things. For example, in 1915, during his presidency, and with his knowledge, 160 Catholic priests were shot. Now, when he heard the news of this slaughter, John Lind, who was an advisor to U.S. President Woodrow Wilson, he wrote, "Great news! The more priests they kill in Mexico, the happier I shall be." And he also wrote to an American Protestant minister who had written to President Woodrow Wilson protesting the persecution of Catholics in Mexico under Carranza. And this same man, John Lind, this American, he wrote back to this minister saying, "After prostitution, the worst thing in Mexico is the Catholic Church. Both must disappear." Now, after Carranza, then we see a man by the name of Álvaro Obregón. He was in office from 1920 to 1924. He was followed by Calles, the monster. Now, Carranza's effort to thwart the church were terrible, but they were nothing at all compared to what Calles would do. Calles was a general in the Mexican army. He rose to power during the years of the Mexican Revolution. This is the time of Pancho Villa and those guys riding around with big sombreros and shooting people. Well, that's when he came to power because he was a general in that time. He eventually became governor of Sonora, and he was known as a rather brutal governor. One of the things he did when he became governor was to banish all Catholic priests from the territory. Why would he do that, you might ask? Well, he did it for one reason, because he was a militant, vocal atheist and a 33rd degree Mason. And he made it his business, wherever possible, that he would enact and enforce policies that would persecute and, if possible, obliterate the Catholic Church in Mexico. He wrote once, "The Catholic Church is the unique cause of all Mexico's misfortunes." Now, when Calles came to power, one of the first things he did was he formed his own patriotic church. Does that sound familiar? He formed a patriotic church with the collaboration of some schismatic priests. He openly supported Protestant missionaries in Mexico. He even funded the construction of more than 200 Protestant schools in an effort to weaken the Catholic Church. He didn't care about Protestantism. The only reason he did that was because he knew that that would be a way to, as we just read, weaken the Catholic Church. Under Callas, the full weight of persecution against the Catholic Church broke out, provoking what became known as the Cristero Wars. The Cristeros were the Catholics who fought back militarily with guns and hand grenades against the oppression that was meted out against the Catholic Church by Callas and his people. In 1924, President Callas declared, quote, "Now there must be a psychological revolution. We must penetrate and take hold of the minds of the children and of the youth because they must belong to the revolution," end quote. And thus began a systematic ratcheting up of governmental opposition and oppression against the Catholic Church. Catholic schools everywhere were outlawed and confiscated. Public school attendance was now mandatory for all children, and atheism was now taught as an approved course in all public schools. So parents, just imagine yourselves living in 1924 anywhere in Mexico. Not only can you not homeschool, not only can you not send your children to a Catholic school, but they have to go by law to the public school where they will be indoctrinated with militant atheism. In June of 1926, June 14th, to be specific, Callas issued the law reforming the penal code, also known as the Callas Law. It effectively outlawed the Catholic Church in Mexico by expanding and strengthening those elements of the Mexican Constitution that had been put in place in 1917 by then-President Carranza. These laws severely restricted the activities of the Catholic Church. Indeed, they openly persecuted the Church. Now, as I was thinking about the title of this conference, it was not lost on me that it's entitled The Battle for the Faith. Well, we're about to hear right now the details of a particular battle that was fought by many valiant Catholics who did not willingly allow what happened to them to take place. I'm reminded of Ezekiel 13, verse 5, in which God talks about men who went up into the breaches and built up a wall for the house of Israel that it might stand in battle. These Catholics in Mexico, these were the ones who formed that wall. They formed the wall with their very bodies. They stood in the face of this implacable government hatred of God and the Catholic Church. They really were, as St. Peter talks about in 1 Peter chapter 2, living stones that were built up as a holy edifice of sacrifice and martyrdom to defend the liberty of Catholic believers, indeed to ensure that the Catholic faith in Mexico might not be so ruthlessly stamped out and obliterated as had been planned, but might be preserved in the land where our Blessed Lady appeared 400 years earlier. They knew, as it says in Acts chapter 5, verse 19, that they must obey God rather than men. Here are some of the things that were enforced upon the Catholic Church by the Callas Law. Every Mexican who had any kind of public office, whether police, civil servants, mayors, governors, or dog catchers, all of them, in any capacity, they were required to take a public oath of acceptance of the decrees of the Mexican government. Anyone who refused was either imprisoned or executed by firing squad. Many thousands of heroic Catholic men and women, primarily lay people, were punished this way. A 500 peso fine for wearing priestly or religious garb in public, and imprisonment for up to 5 years for even questioning these laws. Spanish words and phrases, this one is kind of silly, but Spanish words and phrases such as adios and si Dios quiere, which means goodbye and if God wills it, they were outlawed. And you could inform on people who said adios. You know, you could tell the local police and that person would be fined. People who broke that law, if they were caught, they would be fined with either money or they would be sent to prison for a time. All native Mexican clergy were required to register with the state, and without this official government authorization, it was forbidden for them to minister to the faithful in any way whatsoever under pain of capital punishment. That means no baptisms, no masses, no confessions, nothing. Or maybe I should say, nada. No priest could minister without the express permission of the government. All Catholic churches, cathedrals, basilicas, and convents were confiscated by the government. The anti-Catholic laws enacted during this time required that all Catholic Church property be legally transferred immediately to specially designated committees of laymen who were appointed by the local mayor or governor. No priest or bishop was permitted to administer a parish, and the Catholic Church could own no property. All religious orders were outlawed. In some places, it was decreed that there could be only one bishop residing in an entire Mexican state. All foreign priests and nuns were expelled from the country. Any and all schools were disbanded and shut down simply for having a religious name, even if it wasn't a Catholic school. If it had a religious name in it, you'd be shut down. Or if it was a non-religious school, but somebody happened to find a religious statue or a Bible or something like that, it would be confiscated and shut down. All seminaries, convents, and other religious houses were disbanded and shut down. Many Catholic charitable works were also shut down. Some Mexican faithful, especially in rural areas, were rounded up and sent to concentration camps where many of them died of disease, and often by the rifle and machine gun fire that soldiers would train upon them to cut them down at the slightest show of Catholic piety. Catholics who defied the government saw their haciendas, crops, homes, and even entire villages burned to the ground. In response to the government's confiscation of all church property, the bishops of Mexico issued an interdict forbidding Catholics from participating in government-approved committees or even from entering a Catholic church that was now in the clutches of the Mexican government. I'd like to read to you some eyewitness accounts, first from a man named Olivier Lelibre. He says, on July 24, 1926, Cardinal Gasparri sent a telegram from Rome to the Mexican episcopate saying, under no condition will we accept the registering of priests. He goes on to say, the bishops decided to suspend public worship throughout the land starting on July the 31st. All places of public worship would be closed. There would be no masses offered nor sacraments administered throughout the country except in private chapels. This unheard of, inexplicable decision was designed to push the Mexicans, it seems, to revolt against the government, and it seems to have worked. Here's something that one person who was there in those final days of July described. He says, people began to come to put their consciences well in order, even though it was already time to begin working in the fields. With each passing day, more and more peasants streamed into the villages from the neighboring hamlets, their pale faces and sorrowful eyes bespeaking their anguish. There were three priests in a particular parish, not enough to confess so many people. Despite being in the confessional from dawn to dusk with no time to eat or rest, still, they could not hear the confessions of all who came. How surprising to see someone estranged from the sacraments come to receive forgiveness of his sins, and others who lived in concubinage come to seek out the confessor asking to be united in marriage. A little later, he describes, he says, the day that this came to be law, there was to be a mass at midnight, and by the end of Vespers, the church could no longer contain the immense multitude of the faithful. One after the other, the faithful would go on their knees from the door to the altar. No one wanted to see this most sorrowful moment arrive, but God was going to permit it to come to pass. At 11:30 p.m., the bells dolefully tolled the hour of the Mass. The nocturnal adorers, the pious associations, and the Catholic social organizations with their groups and their banners, they were all there with all the faithful. At midnight, the Blessed Sacrament was exposed and Mass began. After the Gospel, our dear Father Gonzalez mounted the pulpit. He had barely gone up when all the people gathered at the foot of the altar and began to cry. The broken words that Father spoke, full of sorrow, were interrupted by the sobs of the people. After communion, at the end of Holy Mass, we were given the benediction with His Divine Majesty, referring to the monstrance. Finally, Father divested himself of his vestments and knelt at the foot of the altar, his eyes fixed on the image of our Lord. Silently, he took leave of him and went out through the midst of the faithful. Christ and his minister had departed. From the first days of August, the Mexican people, deprived of their priests, only 200 remained with their faithful, and their bishops, only one remained out of 38. They were left with nothing except the rallying cry, Viva Cristo Rey, long live Christ the King. This was the message, this was the cry of the Cristeros. In fact, one of the Cristeros wrote before he was executed by the government, he says, we are going to perish, we will not see victory, but Mexico needs all this blood for its purification. Christ will receive the homage which is due to him. And it's true that blood did flow, and interestingly, only Ireland, of all the countries, broke diplomatic relations with Mexico. Not the United States, not any other country, only Catholic Ireland. Now, the Freemasons understood exactly what was going on, and in December 1926, the New Age, which is the, or at the time was, the American publication of Freemasonry, they declared their opinion, saying, the Catholic Church has perverted the Mexicans for 400 years. Calla's merit is to have delivered them from ignorance and superstition. That is why he can count on our understanding and on North America's support. In May of 1926, the Scottish Rite Masonic Lodge in Mexico City awarded President Calles the Masonic Medal of Merit, and the following month it issued a press release saying that, quote, international masonry accepts responsibility for everything that is happening in Mexico and is prepared to mobilize all its forces for the methodical, integral application of the agreed-upon program for this country. Now, I'm sure you can all guess what the agreed-upon program was for Mexico. As a result of Calles' laws outlawing the Catholic Church, the Mexican people were in a complete quandary. They had to live, they had to eat, they had to work. And when an elderly shopkeeper was beaten almost within an inch of his life by some policemen, simply because he had in his little tienda a sign that said, Viva Cristo Rey, that became the rallying cry of the people. And many of them started to boycott all the state-owned businesses and services. One example is that it's reported that railroad traffic declined by nearly 75%, and the loss of revenue to the state made the government even more determined to crush the Catholic spirit of the Mexican people. Keep in mind, before these laws were enacted, there were approximately 5,000 priests ministering to the Catholic population of approximately 15 million people. By the end of the Cristero Uprising in 1934, that number had shrunk to only 334 priests who were officially authorized by the government. 17 of the Mexican states were entirely without priests for years. Many Catholics participated in public processions, singing hymns and declaring their love for God and the church. And the typical government response was to have police and soldiers fire on them with rifles and machine guns. And yet, they continued to process in public. One Cristero leader, Valencia Gallardo, was captured by the Federales and he was executed by torture after tying him to a stake in the ground. When he cried out, Viva Cristo Rey, they cut out his tongue. Unable to speak, he was able to get one hand free of the ropes and he pointed defiantly to heaven. So they cut off his hand. They eventually killed him by bashing his skull in with their rifle butts. One Catholic priest, a certain Father Reyes, received similar treatment. Tortured for 3 days with fire, he was finally shot several times. They thought he was dead, but somehow he managed to lift himself and weakly cry out, Viva Cristo Rey, long live Christ the King, at which point they shot him again to make sure he was dead this time. This heroic priest was canonized by Pope John Paul II in the year 2000. Now the Cristeros, not all of them were good holy people, but most of them were. They were fighting for the Catholic faith. They were fighting for their very existence as Mexicans. I'd like to read to you an interesting excerpt from the Order of the Day written by one of the generals of the Cristero Army who was killed in combat in 1927. Listen to this. Does this sound like what a typical general might write to his troops? Disciplinary measures affecting the Southern Division. The division chiefs of the south of Jalisco, Colima, and Nayarit, and western Michoacan have adopted the following measures. Number one, to render an official, public, and solemn homage to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, Sovereign King of our army, and to humbly and lovingly consecrate to him all the works and all the persons of this division. Two, to never omit under any pretext the daily group recitation of the Rosary to the Blessed Virgin Mary of Guadalupe, and to accord this observance the same priority as a strict disposition of military regulation. And number three, whenever possible, to arrange things to allow all the leaders, officers, and soldiers to officially fulfill the precepts of Sunday worship, confession, and communion. And finally, to guarantee divine protection during the battles by making the army and the Catholics prepare themselves by humble, confident prayer and by recommending that they make acts of perfect contrition before battle. On November 18, 1926, Pope Pius XI issued his encyclical Iniquis Afflictisque, which regarded the persecution of the Catholic Church in Mexico. I would love to quote to you lengthy sections. I'm not able to do so because of time, but I would urge you to go to the Vatican website, vatican.va, and you can type in just Mexico, or you can go to the section for Pope Pius XI and pull up this encyclical and read it. It's not terribly long, but it does demonstrate to us that the Catholic Church, then as now, says to corrupt laws and corrupt governments, or evil laws and even evil governments, it says that Catholics can never be compelled to go along with laws that are wrong, and that Catholics have an obligation, duty-bound, to stand up, whatever the cost might be, in the face of the kinds of diabolical things that the Mexican government, for example, was perpetrating on the people. I'd like to read to you a little bit from a book. It's called Mexican Martyrdom, and it was written by Father Wilfred Parsons. It was written shortly after these events took place, but let me just give you a little flavor of what was going on during this persecution. The hands of the rector of the parish church of Tamasula were cut off to prevent his ever saying Mass again. The mutilation killed him. January 2nd, attempts made to burn down the Church of Jesus and Mary in Mexico City. At the station of Santa Maria, Father Garcia gave absolution to a man dying of a gunshot wound. For this cause alone, the guards broke his hand and mutilated him in his ears, nose, tongue, and eyes. He died in the train, and the soldiers dropped his body at the station of Encarnacion de Diaz, where they abandoned it. January 7th, all churches in the state of Tabasco were seized by the government. The cathedral has been turned into a school and all sacred objects stolen. January 10, a group of federal soldiers took out, desecrated, and destroyed the statues from two churches in Zacatecas. January 5, a priest and a young man, brother of a certain Gonzalez Flores, one of the first persons sacrificed for the cause of Christ on April the 1st, 1927, were shot. The young man was killed for publishing a small newspaper in connection with the religious persecution. January 10th, at Tepitatlan, Jalisco, officers of the Calles Army searched all churches and private homes and looted them of all sacred objects. Later on, they profaned the sacred utensils and passed through the streets drunk and showing them as their trophies. He's talking about chalices, ciboriums, etc. January 25, the police raided the Catholic school of the Sisters of St. Joseph and imprisoned 21 nuns and two lay teachers. The school was closed. February 5, this was reported in a certain newspaper of a young Antonio Ibarra of Michoacan who was cruelly maltreated by soldiers. Before he was hanged, he made an effort to hold himself up with one hand and loosening the rope around his neck, he shouted, "Long live Christ the King." February 7th, Father Perez, rector of the parish church in Salamanca, was imprisoned in that city under the false pretense that he was implicated in the armed movement. He was sent from Salamanca to Irapuato and murdered on the road. Another priest was murdered in the same way at Querétaro. February 12, Father Junipero de la Vega and brother Humble Martinez, after imprisonment at Zamora, were shot on the road between Zamora and Yurecuaro in Michoacán. February 18th, the Seminary of Puebla closed, and the rector, three priests, and 14 lay professors imprisoned. February 29th, 1928, the village church made into a barracks. Canon Martinez and his brother Agustin killed. The murder of Father Daniel Perez, thereby proving the falsity of the accusation against Father Perez as participating in the rebellion. March 15th, Father Villarreal and five civilians were submitted to a mock court-martial, entirely illegal since they were all civilians, and immediately taken into the nearby field where they were shot as reprisals for the lack of success in capturing the bishop whose residence had been raided and looted. Two young men were murdered at Zamora in Michoacán. One was compelled to shout, "Long live Calles!" Instead, however, he shouted, "Long live Christ the King!" The soldiers then began to cut off his ears, and having obtained no better results, they cut off his tongue. The other man embraced him, and the soldiers shot the group, killing the two young men. Miss Maria Guadalupe from Ciudad Victoria was captured so that she might inform where the rector of the church and some other Catholics were hidden. As she refused, the soldiers began to tear off her fingers. The mutilation continued until she became exhausted, then they finally killed her. In Jalisco, the soldiers set fire to the church. Catholics tried to put out the fire, and the soldiers killed them all with machine guns. Again in Jalisco, a certain man was returning to his house from his work. Some soldiers came up to him and asked him for the password. He answered, "Christ the King." The soldiers then cut off one of his ears. So then he shouted, "Long live Christ the King." The soldiers cut off his tongue, and yet he tried to proclaim the faith without a tongue, so they stabbed him to death. On August 15th, 1927, this time from Guanajuato, about a certain Anselmo Padilla who was captured, the soldiers cut off his nose and made several cuts in his face because he refused to cheer for Calles and shouted, "Long live Christ the King." When he was almost exhausted, they tore off the skin of his feet and compelled him to walk upon fire, upon which he died. This person shot, that person buried alive, hundreds, thousands of people, Catholics murdered for the faith. One final example. In Hidalgo, Mother Superior of the nuns of Ejutla was shot, and all the other nuns were delivered to the soldiery, for what purpose you can only imagine. One particular priest in Zacatecas was arrested. One of his captors put on the priest's cassock and asked him to confess. He and a small boy were then stabbed to death. Another priest who had been carrying the Blessed Sacrament to a sick man was captured, tortured, and killed. And the examples go on and on. It's too horrendous, really, to contemplate, but there it is. Now, the end of this Cristero uprising is as strange as it is tragic. In 1929, fully 75% of Mexico had come under the direct control of the victorious Cristero army. In fact, the government ceased even trying to impose authority in those mainly rural areas. The U.S. ambassador to Mexico at that time, Dwight Moro, he eventually was able to negotiate a ceasefire agreement between the Vatican and the Mexican government. It's very difficult to explain exactly why this was done, although some people have theorized that it might have been possible because of some Masonic infiltration at the Vatican. Who knows? I certainly don't. The main thing is that this negotiated agreement called for a truce between the Cristeros and the government. Now, Jesus Degollado, who was the commander-in-chief of the Cristeros on the day that this announcement was made, he made these statements to his troops. His Holiness the Pope, by the intermediary of the Most Excellent Apostolic Nuncio, has decided, for reasons which are unknown to us, but which as Catholics we accept, that public worship shall be resumed tomorrow without the law being changed. This arrangement has wrested from us that which is most noble and most holy on our flag, at the moment when the Church has declared that she will resign herself to what she has obtained. Consequently, the National Guard assumes responsibility for the conflict. As for ourselves as men, we have a satisfaction that no one can take from us. The National Guard does not disappear defeated by its enemies, but rather abandoned by the very ones who were to be the first to receive the fruit of our sacrifices and abnegation. Ave Christ. Those who for you are going to humiliation, to exile, and perhaps to an inglorious death, with the most fervent love, salute you and once more proclaim you as king of their country. So the Cristeros laid down their weapons, they stopped fighting, and as soon as they had laid down their weapons, President Calles had up to 6,000 of these Cristero leaders and soldiers rounded up, and all of them were executed by firing squad. I'll speak just for a moment about Father Miguel Pro, a Jesuit priest very well known in this country. He was a Mexican who found his vocation to the Society of Jesus. He studied in Belgium. For a time, he was in Nicaragua. One of the stories about his life that is very moving is his desire and willingness to suffer for the Lord. And he had to undergo abdominal surgery one day. And his health was so delicate because of this illness that he had that he wasn't able to have any type of anesthesia. So, clutching the crucifix and biting down on a rag of some sort, they performed this operation on his stomach completely without anesthesia. And the eyewitnesses there said that the only sign of his pain, besides the expressions on his face, were the tears that rolled down his cheeks. He didn't cry out, he didn't groan, he didn't do anything. And in his writings, Father Miguel Pro talks frequently about his love of suffering because it's a way of helping to win faster and more mercifully the freedom of his fellow Mexican people. He went back to Mexico after his ordination, returning in 1926 undercover. And one of the things that made Father Pro so well known and so beloved was the way in which he went about his priestly ministry. And he did all kinds of crazy things to outwit the Mexican police, I should say. Such things as one day he was being chased by a carload of police. They had found him, and they were hot on his trail. And he was in a cab that was a little bit further ahead. And the cab went around a corner, and he told the cab driver, he says, slow down just a little bit, but keep speeding up once I get out of the car. So he rolled out of the car, and there happened to be a pretty young woman standing there. So he locked arms with her and started chatting with her as if she was his girlfriend. And so the police came whizzing by, and they saw the couple, and they thought, well, that obviously isn't the priest. So they kept going. And, of course, they found a taxi cab without any passenger. Another time he was going to bring Holy Communion to the prisoners in one of the jails in Mexico City, and He came to the prison dressed as a policeman, and he walked right into the very center, talk about the belly of the beast, he walked into the very center of the place that was directing the search for him, dressed as a policeman, and he came to interrogate the prisoners. And of course, he gave them our blessed Lord and Holy Communion. Another time, he was very close to being captured when the house that he was in celebrating Mass, he had just finished celebrating Mass, somebody informed, and the house was surrounded by police, and he was able at the very last minute to sneak out. And this will show you a little bit of his type of personality. He went to some other house nearby and put on his police inspector. Well, eventually he was captured. There was an assassination attempt against General Obregón, and the car from which that political figure, that car had been traced when they captured the driver. The car was traced to Father Pro's brother, Humberto Pro. Now, neither Father Pro nor his brothers had any role to play in this assassination plot. They were completely ignorant of the fact that it had been planned. But a few weeks before, Father Pro's brother had sold the car to the man who was actually involved in the plot, and he had never bothered to change the registration in the car. So the government decided, well, this priest is part of the plot. So they lined him up in front of the firing squad on November 23rd, 1927, and shot him at 10:38 in the morning. This was filmed. The photographs have been widely disseminated. What we see is that before he was executed, Father Pro asked to be able to pray, so he knelt down and prayed for a few minutes, and then he stood there in front of the firing squad with his crucifix in one hand and the rosary in the other, and he shouted out, "Viva Cristo Rey," and the bullets flew, and he fell to the ground. And then, just to make sure he was dead, the sergeant came up with his musket and put it right at his head and fired that final shot to ensure his death. Father Pro died a martyr that day, with the rallying cry of not just Mexican Catholics, but I believe all Catholics, then and now, on his lips, "Viva Cristo Rey." And so, in view of this present darkness that you and I find ourselves in today in the United States, this darkness that's engendered by the culture of death, especially through the horror of legalized abortion and euthanasia, the Pope, when he wrote that encyclical about what was going on in Mexico, when he wrote that back in the 1920s, he said that there is nothing which we cannot not hope for from the Mexican clergy. This is what the Pope said. In other words, he was praising them for their stalwart position. Now, I'm hopeful that some future Pope may write, "There is nothing which we cannot hope for from the American clergy." May it be so. You and I are faced with very similar circumstances. It's possible that today in the United States of America that we may eventually find ourselves in a similar situation to what our Mexican brothers and sisters underwent in their great persecution of the 1920s and 1930s. May God help us to remain faithful and true to the faith of our fathers, the gospel of Jesus Christ. And as a way to clarify and conclude my remarks, I'd like to leave you with these words. This is from what's called the Fellowship of the Unashamed. It's a mission statement somebody wrote. I didn't write it, but I certainly subscribe to it. And in light of all the suffering that our Mexican brothers and sisters have gone through, and which we ourselves may go through, you never know, I'd like to read this as a fitting way, I believe, of what we need to do and think and how we should act from this day forward. I am a part of the Fellowship of the Unashamed. The die has been cast. The decision has been made. I have stepped over the line. I won't look back, let up, slow down, back away, or be still. My past is redeemed. My present makes sense, and my future is in God's hands. I am finished and done with low living, sight walking, small planning, the bare minimum, smooth knees, colorless dreams, tamed visions, mundane talking, frivolous living, selfish giving, and dwarfed goals. I no longer need preeminence, prosperity, position, promotions, applause, or popularity. I don't have to be right, first, the best, recognized, praised, regarded, or rewarded. I now live by faith. I lean on Christ's presence. I love with patience, live by prayer, and labor with the power of God's grace. My face is set. My gate is fast, my goal is heaven. My road is narrow, my way is rough, my companions are few, my guide is reliable, and my mission is clear. I cannot be bought, compromised, detoured, lured away, turned back, deluded, or delayed. I will not flinch in the face of sacrifice, hesitate in the presence of adversity, negotiate at the table of the enemy, ponder at the pool of popularity, or meander in the maze of mediocrity. I won't give up, shut up, let up, or slow up until I have stayed up, stored up, prayed up, paid up, and spoken up for the cause of Christ. I am a disciple of Jesus. I am a Catholic. I must go until he comes, give until I drop, speak out until all know, and work until he stops me. And when he returns for his own, he will have no difficulty recognizing me. My banner is clear. I am a part of the fellowship of the unashamed. And I thank you all very much. God bless you. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this presentation from Patrick Madrid. If this presentation has helped you in your faith journey, and you would like to hear more of these inspiring talks, we invite you to visit our website and enroll yourself or a friend in our CD of the Month Club. As a listener, your input is very important to us in helping us to improve this program to reach many more souls for Christ and His Church. We would like to send you a free online gift for your time when you complete a very brief survey on the presentation you've just heard. You will find the survey on our website, lighthousecatholicmedia.org. Thank you for listening, and may God richly bless you and your family.